My name's Simon. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sitting back here in my chair, and I got a buzz on, and I'm sitting here, and I'm going, boy, things just don't change. Here I am sober, and I'm still trying to get high. I went for a really long run before I came here, and I got that endorphin high going on. If anybody is a runner here, they'll understand. And before I went on the run, I was having a nice day. I visited some friends today and did a Thanksgiving brunch. And afterwards I said, it would be nice to kind of get a small buzz on tonight before I went to the meeting. So for a long run. And it's amazing that things don't change. I'm an addict, you know, and I just like to get high. Yesterday I went out with a friend and we went mountain biking for about 4 hours or so. And we just beat the crap out of each other and you know, adrenaline going down hills and up hills. And at the end of the day, it felt like we were using all weekend because we just, you know, destroyed. And we said, wow, we're still destroying ourselves. This is kind of ridiculous, you know. But it's a good thing. It's a good way to get high. So I guess I'll qualify myself. I started using drinking probably an early age, I don't know, normal 12, 13. But I started using the alcohol and drugs because I liked the effects of them, like everyone else, right? And when I drank, it made me feel good. When I started mixing it with a little bit of pot or hash, you know, many times through high school, I was right on the borderline, and if I drank and I smoked too much hash, I would be, you know, sick. So I found like a real happy medium, and it was like just on the line. I found other drugs in high school. I started buying Ritalin off kids and Dexedrine, and then taking a whole bunch of them and drinking coffee to get high. You know, and all the other normal drugs that people do in high school. Alcohol was always my primary drug of choice. I remember I grew up in Prince Edward Island, and then eventually I moved out west, and I was working in the oil patch for a number of years. And everyone, I mean, we were a crew of about 40 guys, and everyone on the whole crew were potheads. I mean, they just smoked weed all day. And we would be driving in the trucks to and from, and I would smoke with them sometimes. But it was like every time I took, you know, every time I got stoned, I'd be like, oh, why did I just do that? So alcohol was my thing. I really, really enjoyed the end of the day. You know, I would skip dinner because if I ate, it would take longer for the alcohol to have its effect on me. I would usually, you know, just pound a six-pack at the end of the day, get a nice buzz on, and that would just be enough to get the courage to go out. And then I would spend the rest of the evening, you know, heavy drinking and whatnot, until 3 or 4 in the morning, 1 or 2 hours sleep, and show up at work the next day. Usually, you know, I would be leaning on people at the safety meeting, and I could, you know, hardly walk, let alone drive a truck. That company actually, after being with them for a few years, they fired me because I wrapped one of their trucks around a telephone pole one night. So moving around, I mean, when I left Prince Edward Island, it was because I got into a lot of trouble. I was drinking a lot as well. When I moved out west, I started doing heavier drugs, introduced me to cocaine, ecstasy. I used to do cocaine on the back of toilet bowls at clubs. And then I discovered a drug that I could take by pill, and I said, you know, I was always about efficiency, right? And so I said, why don't I just take a pill and then I don't have to be in a stall all night snorting, you know, crap off a bathroom toilet. And so I was on the ecstasy kick and raged for a while. Went out to BC and saw Hastings Street, if anybody's ever got to visit that area. It's real something. It scared the hell out of me for about 3 days. Then I went back to Edmonton and kept doing the same things. And what it seemed was my family members started, you know, seeing patterns. I knew I was an alcoholic. You know, I got step one when I was in high school. I knew that I was alcoholic. My grandfather was alcoholic. My mother recognized it right away. And my friends said, Simon, you're alcoholic. And by then I had girlfriends leaving me saying, you're alcoholic, you're not going to change. I was never a violent drunk, never blacked out, but I drank all the time. And so I knew that I was alcoholic, but I didn't know or want any other way of living, because that was the only thing that was important to me. That made me feel alive. It put, you know, the world just kind of went, you know, that, I don't know if you, today I can meditate and I feel peace of mind, you know, I feel serenity today. But back then, drinking alcohol was the only thing that would allow me to feel that way. So I would live my life essentially isolating, feel restless, irritable, discontent, like I talk about in the Big Book, and very antisocial. And this would continue for a few days, and then once I got a few drinks into me, I would feel like going out and socializing with people, and it was just this vicious cycle. You know, go out, socialize, drink, drugs, you know, for a few days, and then come back and sit on the couch and order pizza and watch movies and wouldn't answer my phone because I'd be filled with anxiety and depression. I was diagnosed with manic depressive, I mean, at a young age. The doctor said, here's your antidepressants, but you're not supposed to take alcohol on them or other drugs. I don't think I've gone, you know, more than from the age of 13 till age of 23. I didn't go more than a week without a drink or a drug. It was impossible for me. So I tried to quit a few times on my own. I tried the geographical cures. I mean, I moved out west, then I moved down to California. Every time I moved somewhere, and then I moved to Montreal, every time I you know, did this relocation, saying, this time things are going to be different. This time I'm going to change my life. I'm going to slow down drinking. You know, I'm going to drink normal. I'm going to lay off the cocaine, or I'm not going to get into this scene. I'll have a new person, and I'll make new friends. And it seemed like every time I went to a new town, it was like my ears had radar. I could pick up, I'd be at a you know, social gathering. And by the end of the night, I was with the one guy in the room that had drugs. You know, it was like, you know, well, we all spoke the same language, I guess. So everywhere I went, it was the same thing over and over. And I hated all the places that I was. I hated living in Prince Edward Island. I hated living in Alberta. California, I despised. I came to Montreal. I was here for about a year. Hated Montreal. My attempts of getting sober on my own. I attempted in high school once or twice. I remember saying, you know, just swearing off alcohol, saying, never again, never again. I'm going to just, you know, live a humble life. I'm done. I'm done partying. I'm not going to go on any vacations anymore. I'll sleep in through Christmas. New Year's, forget it. I'll ignore it. My birthday, doesn't matter. Don't need it. You know, all of these occasions where I thought alcohol was required to enjoy, because it seemed, you know, that was in television, and my family always enjoyed good scotches and wines and whatnot. I couldn't imagine having a life without it. And then when I would try to stop on my own, you know, the bare knuckling it, I'd turn on the television and it'd be like Cheers is on. And then I'd be like, oh, change the channel again. And then I'm watching Frasier. At the end of the day, he always comes in and he pours himself a nice glass of sherry and enjoys the sophistication, right? So it just seemed everywhere. I couldn't imagine getting away from it. And here I am trying to stop, and it was like, well, it's like everybody lives like this. You know, maybe I don't have a problem. I attempted to go to a rehab when I was out west. They told me that I had to stay sober for 2 weeks before they admit me. Of course, that wasn't going to happen. Usually, whenever I made a decision to stop drinking, it usually lasted a few days, right? I would make a decision and say, this time things are going to be different, and I'm going to go to the gym, and I'm going to start exercising and eating right, and all of these things, these good things. And And within, you know, a few days, it was back at the store, 12-pack, pack of cigarettes, and away I went. And, you know, maybe next week I'll stop, or maybe tomorrow I'll stop. So I'm in Montreal, and this time I had a girl who decided to stay around for a while. And eventually she wised up and started going to Al-Anon meetings. She went to two Al-Anon meetings, and she came back and she said, "You're an alcoholic, you're not going to change. I'm leaving you." And by this time, this was like the third or fourth time that this had happened, and it was becoming apparent that everyone in my life was leaving me because of my consumption. I thought I was a nice guy. I thought I was easy to get along with. I couldn't manage my life. Everyone who came into my life, they had to manage it for me. It was ridiculous. My driver's license had expired. I had no Medicare card. My phone was being cut off. I was living here in Montreal. It was summertime. The Hydro-Québec or gas net came and cut off my gas. So I said, it's summertime. You know, I'll take cold showers. Big deal. I had anxiety from opening the mail. Every time mail would come, I was like, oh. Because I knew it was going to be a bill, you know, or a collector, or telling me, you know, just basically putting it in my face how messed up my life was. I would go to the bank, and I found out that the bank started seizing my accounts because I had owed money on credit cards and whatnot. It was a complete mess. It was an absolute complete mess. And my family didn't want to help me anymore. They'd stopped, you know, helping me quite a while ago because, of course, my mother knew that I was alcoholic, and she had gone to Al-Anon for her father. And my father was a guy who just said, "Tough luck. You know what? I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to be an enabler, if you want to call it." He went to some meetings when I was in high school because I was so messed up, you know. So I'm here in Montreal, and I really got no other choice. My girlfriend's leaving me. I walk into the place that I was working, which was a nightclub, because by this time this was the only employment that I could have, because, you know, I usually wake up about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I figured if I'm going to spend all my life in a bar, they might as well pay me to do it. And I walked into the bar where I was also doing some illegal activity, and they told me, "Simon, we know what you're doing, but we can't catch you, and thank you very much, goodbye." This was right before Grand Prix weekend. I had absolutely no money. I had an eviction notice. I'd been to the Régie a few times. Am I painting a picture for you here? You know, things were pretty peachy. And I knew about this rehab. They had told me that they may accept me if I went and got a physical. I called a friend of mine, and I started crying. I broke down on the phone, and I remember I had this stained glass lamp that my mother had given me, and it was this beautiful stained glass lamp from Prince Edward Island with a blue herring on it. And I was painting my room one evening, and I was always drinking. Everything required alcohol at this time. And I went to move a table that this lamp was on, and of course I was drunk, and the glass lamp fell. And it was like one of these kind of realizations that wouldn't have happened if I wasn't drinking. Why is it that every time I'm drinking, every time something happens in my life, it's always because I'm drinking? You know, I've been in numerous car accidents, never got a DUI, just luck, I guess. But there wasn't, I mean, I've been in a dozen car accidents, and not one of those accidents I didn't have some kind of substance in me. I've been sober now 6 years. Haven't had one car accident. You know, is it just a coincidence? Anyway, so this lamp is on the floor, and it was one of the only things that I'd lugged around with me from different places, and it meant something to me. And now this thing is laying on the floor, and it's smashed. And I realized, you know, this was another kind of realization that every time something bad happens in my life, it's because I'm drinking. So I called up an old friend. She said, "Oh, love, don't worry. I know all about you, your type. My father's an alcoholic." And because at the time, I couldn't help myself. You know, like I said, all the things in my life were chaotic. I couldn't even go down and get a health care card. So she made a bunch of phone calls, got me an interview at a rehab, you know, told me this is the address you have to go to, and, you know, really kind of took me by the hand and led me into a rehab. And even then, I hesitated about going. You know, I said, oh, yeah, I'll show up sometime. Well, when I walked into the office, that morning my girlfriend had left me, I had an eviction notice, I walked into the bar I was working, they said, sorry, you've got no more job here. I really had nowhere else to go. So I went from the bar that I'd been working at up the street to a medical center and said, I need to get a physical because I have to go to rehab. And I remember when I was walking up to this rehab, I had almost a seizure. You know, I just started sweating. And I guess it was my body reacting to all the crap that I was putting in my body because I just had this huge heat flash. I fell on the concrete. I threw up a little bit, and I came to, and all my clothes were soaked, and it was just my body rejecting all the crap that I was putting in myself. Anyway, so I went to to see the doctor. They gave me a clean bill of health. They said, you know, you can check into a rehab. And I got out to this place, and I remember the first night I was there. It was June 24th was when I arrived there, 2002. And I'm in bed. I went to a place called Beaver. And I'm in bed, and across the street there's a cemetery, and I've got this tiny room. And the beds, I mean, were on wheels, and they were like this big, and you just had to move, and the thing, you know, rocked, and you couldn't sleep on these things. And there was plastic sheet covers over the bed in case someone urinated or vomited. And also the pillows had plastic sheet covers on them. No air conditioning. Plus 30, 32 that day or that whole week. So I'm trying to go to sleep and I'm sticking to this bed and I lift up and the pillow stuck to my face and I thought to myself, how did I get here? You know, like I grew up in a good family, had good parents. How the hell did I get here? And I made a decision when I was there. I said, no matter, this is it. I got nowhere else. I got no place to go to when I get back. I don't have a job. I'm going to give this thing my all, no matter what. This is the most important thing for me. I've tried this. I've attempted it. This is it. This is the last stop for me because I'm running out of options here. And I made a decision, actually, there because I said, okay, I'm not going to go on any vacations anymore. I'm going to live a real boring, meager existence. I'm going to start reading. Start listening to music. I'll become one of those boring old hermits. That's what I envisioned my life to be. And I was okay with that because living a boring existence, I was done living the chaotic, you know, life that I had been living. I was okay with living this meager, boring, poor existence. And, you know, I went through this rehab thing and I shared about it last night in a meeting that every morning we'd get up, and oh God, it was tough to get up in the morning because I was used to sleeping until, you know, 3 p.m. And they tell you 6 a.m, you're up, let's go, you got chores to do, and they get you walking around outside, and there's just people from all walks of life. You know, most people don't want to be there, most people there, and they got you walking around outside in circles. I mean, you felt like you're in the nut house. I'll tell you the nut house a little later. And somebody said to me, you know, they were talking about the steps, and they said, you know, how do you get sober? And I said, well, you work the steps. Okay, well, what are the steps? Well, first step is you admit you're powerless over alcohol, and, you know, your life's screwed up. I said, well, I'm here, aren't I? And I said, well, what's next? He said, well, then you got to turn it over. What do you mean turn it over? You got to turn it over to the big guy. You got to ask him, basically give him your desire to drink, and he'll take care of it for you. I said, that's it? He said, yeah. Okay. I come from an Irish Catholic family. I can do that. You know, I'm not a big church goer or whatnot, but that sounds reasonable. You know, is that it? Yeah. From that day, I hadn't had a desire to drink. And I haven't since. Now, not to say that I was cured all fine and dandy and life went on as I left, but the desire to drink had lifted, and then they talk about those times of mental lapse when you don't remember that you're alcoholic and you can't drink. They talk about it in the big book, those times of mental lapses. And I haven't had one of those. Thank God that I've got a higher power that's saving me from the drink. Because 99% of the time, I honestly don't want to drink. But there's a period of time where I'm going to have a moment of insanity that I'm going to think, hey, you know what? Let's go for it. Why do I know that that's possible? Because I see it all the time. And I lived it for many, many years. Okay? So, I got out of rehab. They introduced me to AA. I was thinking about it tonight. I got a sponsor. I was lucky, actually. I got this sponsor. And I guess I just got lucky that I didn't choose this guy because I thought he had a great program or anything. I mean, I'd gone to 3 or 4 meetings, and people were telling me, you know, you got to get a sponsor. And I was like, okay, you know, I didn't know anyone in the program. But I got lucky. I chose a sponsor who worked the program and who is diligent about it in everything that he does. You know, and I know a lot of people in the program today, and not everybody works a program like this guy. So I got really lucky that I had somebody that was willing to, you know, take the time and really, you know, go through the steps and just diligent about it. Because not everyone does that, right? I know that I don't always do it with my sponsees. I probably should. I got into some step groups, which were really good. I got, you know, these 17 weeks, you sit around, see some people nodding their heads, and you get to hear everyone else's perspective, which were also good. I got very involved. I started doing some young people's meetings. I was going to this meeting, that meeting. For the first year, I went to, you know, initially I went to maybe 1 or 2 a week. My sponsor said, you know, 2-3 meetings minimum, and I think I was just making the minimum. And then slowly it started to pick up, became a lifestyle for me. I mean, heck, I didn't really have anything else to do. At about 3 months, welfare cut me off welfare, which was a blow, but I had to go out and start working. You know, I had to go live life on life's terms, as they say it. And I got a job with this guy, this big guy. And I bumped into it at a meeting one time. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Oh, well, I need some help doing some carpentry stuff." And I said, "Yeah, sure, you know, I know how to do carpentry." Like, you know, good alcoholic bullshit. So one morning he just showed up at my house, and somebody came to the door and they said, "Simon, there's this big guy with a painter's cap at your door." And it was like 9 a.m. I'm trying to sleep in. I'm depressed, and I really didn't want to get out of bed. So he's like, "Come on, get up. You're coming to work." I went to work with him every morning. He'd show up at my place. "Come on, you're coming to work." I'd work with this guy, and I'd, you know, just be doing drywall and painting and doing bathrooms and cleaning floors. And It was real humbling, you know, because again, that time that I had when I was in the rehab and my face was stuck to the pillow, that was a humbling moment. Well, working with this guy too, you know, sweeping floors and just real humble job, kept my ego in check, and allowed me to go to meetings. You know, I went to meetings about every night. I loved it because I really didn't enjoy every day with this guy. So I try and knock off early to go to a meeting. It was always a good excuse. "Oh, I gotta go. I can't work late tonight. I'm going to a meeting." And he was a member, so he's like, "Okay, fine." I'd rather be at a meeting than working with him. So that was good for my sobriety. And on the other hand, I started also enjoying life a bit. A sponsor said, "Dad, you know how to snowboard or mountain bike?" And I said, "Sure, yeah. No, again, full of shit." So he would take me up to these hills, and we'd go riding, and I remember we'd go up the top of Jay Peak. We'd take the gondola up there. And honestly, that was probably my third time on a snowboard ever, you know. So we're going down, and he just sees me go whoosh, right by him. He's like, "Wow, this guy's fast." And then you just see this poof, you know, a big ball of snow, you know, and I go puffing, and he'd come by laughing, and he'd snowboard by me, and then I'd go by him again, you know, real fast. I know how to stop, you know, and we were at the top of a big hill. So the neat thing about that was that on the lifts, We go up and down. You sit on the lift for 5 minutes. We just talk program. You know, talk program, talk about steps. And this guy must have gotten sick of listening to me whine, because all I did, and I was always pissed off. Every time I called him, he talked about his life, his experience, what he went through when he was first getting sober. And I thought, isn't the sponsor supposed to listen to me, right? And it's all about me, me, me. And I said, why is he telling me about his experiences when he was first getting sober? You know, I don't want to know about that. My life's different. What does that have to do with me getting sober? And I would constantly complain about my life and how I had all this debt and how I didn't have a career and that I didn't have a life for myself and I'm never going to make anything of myself. And I would just constantly complain about this stuff. And he would say, don't worry about that stuff. Worry about your steps. Worry about your inventory. Oh, fuck. Inventory, inventory, inventory. And the more that I, you know, I would keep whining about this stuff, and, you know, you don't understand, you don't understand. And he would tell me stories that, you know, these miraculous stories of how he got out of, you know, trouble and his debts and all whatnot when he was first getting sober. And I would be like, what the hell does that have to do with me, you know? And his response was usually, you know, work on your stuff. Don't worry about all this stuff over here. Don't worry about your life. You can't fix it. Honestly, you've tried to fix your whole life. You can't fix it. Worry about your steps. Worry about your recovery. I said, well, what does that have to do with it? Don't worry about it. So, oddly enough, the more that I started working my program, and I worked it really slow. I mean, I'm not a quickest learner. I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, as they say. I did, in the first year, I did 3 or 4 step groups. You know, I just plowed one after another, hoping that some of the stuff I'm going to retain, you know, I'm going to pick up some of this stuff. And so I drive through him again, and doing steps, and he'd point things out. You know, do you see patterns in this and that? And oddly enough, the more that I worked on this is my program, the more that I worked on my program, my life automatically got better. And I didn't have anything to do with it. You know, I didn't go out and make everything, you know, the world get better and get a great job. And I mean, I was busy over here going to meetings and working steps. And oddly enough, I woke up one day and I was out of debt. You know, I had tremendous friends that I'd never had before in my life, these kinds of friends, members, of course. Because there's something that happens when you work steps with people and when you know, when you're all on this same journey together. There's something really extraordinary that happens. There's this miracle among friends, this camaraderie, you know. And because you get it. You know, you got this common bond. And guys who have worked the steps with and gone through, you know, these trials and errors, and you talk about your problems, and all of a sudden I've got these wonderful friends that I didn't try for. I didn't go to a meeting and said, I'm going to make friends today. You know, I showed up at a meeting, I started setting up some chairs, and we'd have some little chit-chat by the coffee, and I would talk about how, you know, my life is crappy because my bike was just stolen today, and I almost want to cry. And, you know, a few days like that, you know, they add up. And all of a sudden I wake up, and I've got really great friends. I've got this new way of living that didn't exist before. I don't know where it came from. It just evolved. That thing about serenity that they talk about. It started to happen, and I felt peace of mind without drinking, without drugging. I felt I could just sit there, and I'm okay. I don't need a relationship. I don't need drugs, alcohol. That was a miracle in itself. I could enjoy going to a coffee shop on a Sunday morning, sitting in those big comfy chairs, and reading a book. You know, that was actually a really nice Sunday morning for myself. Where did this come from? You know, that wasn't where I was back then. I don't know. It was a pure gift. It was an absolute miracle that I can experience this way of living today. So I've got peace of mind. You know, I'm always growing, looking for things, but it's not like I'm not there. I've arrived, and every day it just keeps getting better. I enjoy time by myself. I don't need relationships with significant others to feel complete. I already feel complete because I feel like my myself, I'm filled up with a relationship with the HP, with God, you know. I'm not going to bang on the whole God drum here. I mean, it's a very personal thing. I know that when I don't connect with the G-man, God, difficulties with that word, okay? On a daily basis, I lose that contact, okay? I lose that conscious contact, the 11 step they talked about. So all this talk of it, you know, I'm doing okay. I'm having the time of my life now. I'm doing things that I never would have imagined. And I'll tell you some of the things I'm doing. I'm not saying it because I want to say, oh, look at me. It's that I heard somebody talking about his experiences and his successes and when I was early sobriety, and I thought to myself, that's what I want. I want to live a normal life. You know, I want to have a normal career. I want to just have a normal life and be happy, joyous, and free. That's really what I want. So, like Gary said, bless you. Every year just seems to be experience. You know, I did a marathon this year, and some members were running the marathon too. And I'd never done something like that before. And I was running by the AA office, and there were some other members on the sideline, and they were cheering me on. It was really something. I got to teach some classes at Vanier. What the hell? You know, I get to stand up and teach people some of the things that I've learned over the years. That's really neat. Career-wise, you know, I that was the biggest. I said, you know what, everything will be right finally once I get. I remember the first couple of years, it was like, you know, I was doing everything. My relationships were great. My sobriety was great, but the job thing. Oh, yeah, I promised I'd tell you the story about the psych ward. So my life was, I was about a year and a half sober, and I decided I'm going to stop working with this guy and doing reno work, and I wanted to kind of explore other options. So I said, I'm going to take a week off, I'm going to clear my head, and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. A lot of pressure. So I took a week off, I think I went to PEI, relaxed for a bit, came back, said, okay, time's up, what are you going to do? And I didn't know. And within a few days, it started getting worse and worse, the depression, the anxiety started to kick in, and within a week, it was difficult for me even to get out of bed. I was so depressed. I was filled with so much anxiety, fear. Oh, I had fear for just to live, to talk to people. You know, I was feeling this, like, where did this come from? A few weeks ago, I was happy, joyous, and free on this pink cloud of AA, you know? And now I'm here, and I have no job, and I don't know what I want to do. So within a week, I couldn't get out of bed. You know, I was really depressed, and I needed help. So I went up to the Montreal General. I waited in the emergency room for a few hours, and eventually triage nurse came and saw me and said, I said, you know what, I'm really depressed. I mean, almost like suicidal, and I really need some help. And they said, well, we don't have any psychiatrists on call. I'm sorry, we're going to have to send you somewhere else. They sent me to the Jewish, and then I go into the Jewish and went through the whole thing there for a couple hours. And they said, well, you know, there's nothing we can do for you. So they bounced me down to the Douglas. And I walk into the Douglas, and of course I sit down. They send me into the psych ward, and I'm sitting, and I wait. And finally a doctor comes to see me, and I'm looking around, and there's, you know, people walking through the Douglas, like, oh, they're crazy. Yeah, I'm crazy too, but they were really crazy. And I'm sober, you know. Here I am, sober a year and a half, and I'm in the Douglas. How did I get here? You know? So I saw this psychiatrist, and she took some time and asked me some questions. At the end, she said, yeah, you shouldn't be here. I said, well, I need to be somewhere because I need help. You know what? Coming to AA, I learned to ask for help. And I knew I needed help, and I couldn't do it for myself. and the prayer wasn't doing it for me, the exercise wasn't doing it for me, I needed some help. And I wasn't looking for a quick fix. I told her, I don't want drugs, okay, I'm an alcoholic, and trust me, drugs is exactly what I want, and I just need someone to work with me because I'm really, you know, I'm feeling pretty depressed right now. So she said, gave me a note and said, you know what, this is my office, you don't belong here, you know, you don't have to spend time in the psych ward. And I went up and we started doing some therapy together. And within 2-3 weeks, you know, we put together a plan, we worked through some issues that I, you know, it's funny, psychiatrists, they find issues you didn't even know you had. And within a few weeks, you know, I was out on the job beat, you know, looking for work. I got a great job out of that, which led to another career, and things just flourished from there. So not to say I didn't have my struggles along the way. I still have them today, you know, but I recognize that I've got things I've got to work on. I've struggled with gambling in sobriety. I haven't gambled in, you know, a year or so. I smoke every once in a while, you know. It's not perfect. It's definitely not perfect, but it sure is a hell of a lot better from where I was coming from, honestly. And one of the other great aspects, the rewards that I've gotten out of this, is the relationship I have with my parents. You know how good it feels to have your parents proud of you just for being you. You know, they respect my opinions, my values. You know, they come to me for advice sometimes when we're talking about, you know, spirituality or finance or, you know, other ideas. It's brilliant. You know, these are people who love me but were absolutely ashamed of me. And to come, you know, within 5-6 years now, it's absolutely brilliant. I couldn't say it any other way. So no matter how it gets, you know, everybody says that, you know, you wouldn't trade the best day of drinking for the worst day of sobriety. I don't know about all that, but but life is really, 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 really good today, and I've got some great friends here tonight that we've gone through many things together. Most of you have heard my share before. Probably going to come up and say to me after me, ah, you're such full of shit, you know, you this and that. But aren't we all? You know? Anyway, so thanks for listening to me.